Oh, thank you so much, Steve. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Monday. I'm Bill Leff. You already know that. Wendy's usually here, but she's not again today. But she will be tomorrow. She's on vacation. Our friend Andrea Darla is sitting in. Hi, Andrea.
Hey,
how are you?
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed you with Dave and out in gym, and I know you're with Mike Toomey later, so this is fun. It's a
Dave
treat.
Dave Neal sat in for a day.
Yeah.
Everyone listening, you'll all get a chance.
Yeah.
At some point, everybody will get a chance to fill in and sit in for Wendy, so just be patient. Wendy, by the way, and boy, does this turn out to be ironic. She is on vacation. She's in Orlando, Florida, which has had the most abysmal week I think you could possibly imagine, with not one but two different incidents. First, the girl from The Voice getting killed by a stalker, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, what happened yesterday with the 50 people at the Pulse nightclub. I imagine you're a little bit talked out on it a little bit because I know Steve covered it extensively through the show, right?
No, you know, I mean, it needs to be talked about. And there's so many new details that are now emerging. They're identifying more of the victims. All have been removed from the nightclub.
Yeah.
And there was some miscommunication early on. Loved ones and family members were waiting to hear to see if, in fact, their loved ones were inside. And now they're starting to find out, yes, they were, or no, they weren't. And just some of the stories that are coming out, too, Bill. This woman was showing some of the text messages from her son who didn't make it.
Yeah.
But just a harrowing story. I mean, it needs to be talked about. New details are going to be emerging all day long and all week long, too.
My heart was going out, well, to everybody involved, but in particular the parents who were playing that waiting game of not knowing that potentially they had a child there at the nightclub. Not a child in terms of them being children, but it was their child.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, you try to think, what would I do in a situation like that? And you can't even figure it out because rationality just goes out the window.
Yeah. And we had, we were talking to an FBI spokesman this morning saying, what do you do in a situation like that? And it's a morbid question, but in this day and age, it can happen anywhere.
I know.
You know, I mean, not to this level, but the woman walking out of the Starbucks on the South Side. And there's random gunfire, or to this level, a mass shooting. You're at a nightclub,
right?
So he was saying that, you know, in a situation like that, when you hear the gunshots, always assume get out,
yeah,
run from the building. If it's nothing, you can go back in.
The problem with that is, and I agree with it, but the problem with that is it's so disorienting because when you're in an enclosed place filled with people and you're hearing these shots, first of all, a lot of the people said, as I watched this all day yesterday, they said their first inclination, their first thought was, this is part of the music, that they were hearing a popping noise that they thought was music. And two different people said, we thought it was fireworks either outside or in another room that somebody was shooting off fireworks. It didn't even occur to them. It could be a guy going through with a gun. But it's so disorienting that you can't figure out exactly where it's coming from. And also you're thinking, I don't know if it's one gunman, if it's a series of gunmen all in different places. So even though, yeah, you know, your survival instinct would kick in and go, I got to get out of here. You don't know which direction is safe.
Right.
You know?
You're right. It is disconcerting because you think you're in a safe haven, a nightclub,
yeah,
a movie theater.
Right.
You don't think.
A school.
Exactly. You don't think, well, I'm going here and I need to be careful because.
Right.
Well, now, I mean, anytime you go into a movie theater, now, Cochran said this morning, first thing he does, strangely, he'll look for the exits.
And don't you find yourself doing that too?
I do. Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost everywhere I go. And then I say to myself, come on, you're being irrational. But sometimes it's that little moment where you just go, no, it's just best to know. What's a plan A? What's a plan B? Should something horrendous happen?
Absolutely.
Just so sad on every level. And of course, other things come into the story. Religion comes into the story.
Yeah.
Politics comes into the story. The hatred of people just because they're gay comes into the story. There's so many things that enter into it that you think to yourself, it's tragic on its own that 50 people are dead and so many more injured. But you throw all those other elements into it. I know back and forth, people have been talking about the way Hillary Clinton is handling this as opposed to the way Donald Trump is handling this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you can do. All you can do is say, we hope that this stops. Our hearts go out to the family. I don't know what else you can do. It's sad that this will become a bit of a political issue, but it is a political issue.
It certainly is. And to your point, too, if you see something, say something.
Yeah.
Well, you had the gunman's wife who was in an abusive situation, reporting it, calling the police, seeking help from her parents. She eventually got away. And his coworker, too, who had told the boss on three separate occasions at the security firm where they worked, three separate times, he said he's very volatile. he has all this angst and all this rage and says the N-word and doesn't like black people and women and makes these gay stereotypes. So, I mean, so people were doing the right thing in reporting him.
Here's what I can't figure out. And well, there's a lot I can't figure out, but I can't figure out this specifically. Is the reason he, the shooter, was on a watch list, is it because people at work were complaining and saying this is a guy who's not only is he racist, but potentially dangerously racist? Is that what kept him on some sort of a watch list? Is it that alone?
It's a great question. I don't know if that's what led to it. It might have been some of the contributing factors, but the FBI did interview him two separate times, first in 2012 and then in 2014.
Right.
But they didn't deem anything that was reported to them strong enough or maybe credible enough to put him on a watch list, per se.
But that then falls under the bracket of, until they do something, you could have 100 people. You could have a guy. You could have everybody this guy knows, right? You could have his dentist. You could have the people he works with, his next-door neighbor, his ex-wife. Everybody could call up, but their answer is going to be the same. Yeah, but he really hasn't done anything.
Right, and then there's a breakdown in communication, too, because did you know that you can buy a gun legally? He bought these two weapons that were used in the shooting legally, and I think they found two more in his car. But he bought two of these weapons last week legally. There should be some sort of communication between, maybe in a database or on the computer, that says, hey, you know what, this guy was questioned twice by the FBI.
Put a flag on his account so when he comes in to get a weapon. But then, if you're him or his lawyer, you could argue, yeah, all right, I'm on a list. I'm on a watch list. I haven't done anything.
Right.
It's still, according to the Constitution, it's his right, despite being on a watch list, no matter how many red flags they throw on there, he could still say, but what have I done? You're denying me one of my rights.
It's a great point.
It's as tricky can be. If you want to jump in on this, please do. We would love to hear from you. We're at 312-981-7200. That's the call line and the text line. It's Bill Leff and Andrea Darlis sitting in for Wendy Snyder today on WGN. All right, it's Bill Leff and it's Andrea Darlis. Andrea's sitting in, kind enough to sit in for Wendy Snyder, who, ironically enough, is in Orlando, Florida, as I mentioned earlier, where these two horrible, horrible things have taken place. She's staying at Disney World, and I was telling Steve Bertrand, that when you're in Disney World, they do their best. I mean, I don't know in a situation like this what goes on, but normally you're off in dreamland. You're at the happiest place on earth. I wonder how these events impacted the people at Disney World. We'll find out from Wendy tomorrow when she comes in. All right, a whole bunch of texts have come in. 815 says, if you get put on a watch list, your FOID card or ability to buy a gun should be revoked for 2 years, sort of like probation. I'd be fine with that. It's not up to me, but at least 2 years.
I'd be fine with that, too. I don't know if he was placed on a watch list. I mean, I don't know if he was on a list, the red flag, like the don't fly list, if you will.
They said yesterday that that authorities were, how did they word it, were aware of him. I'm trying to remember the exact wording that I saw on CNN, but they were saying how they were aware of him. But you can't, there's hundreds of people, maybe thousands of people on these lists.
Yeah.
So what do you do? You can't put all these people under 100% surveillance all the time. That's impossible.
No, there's no time and there's no manpower to do that.
Right. So you're stuck. Let that person have to jump through at least one more hoop to get a gun. Let him petition the court for a gun. That, according to 630. You know what, though? This proves, this is a guy, first of all, born in the United States. So people always talk about, well, you know, if you don't let these people in from foreign countries, you don't have problems like this. This guy was born in the United States.
Born in Florida.
The other thing is, he got a gun legally. There was no problem in him getting as many guns as he wanted to get. So that goes out the window, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Is a FOID card required in every state? I don't know the answer to that. That's from 815.
I think yes, but I'm going to look that up.
I think yes, too, but we're just guessing at this point. We'll find out. Let's get a call or two. Again, we're at 312-981-7200 if you'd like to chime in. John, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Great. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think you're looking at this in the kind of from the wrong angle. This is not making this a gun issue. This is a person, a deranged person who set out to cause all this harm and tragedy, and politicizing this with making it a gun issue, I think, is not justified.
John, what did he use to kill 50? But what did he use to kill the people?
A can of gas, or in Africa where they walk in with daggers and stab several people. I mean, this is—it's not a gun issue. It's The problem is the FBI has their hands strapped because of the Justice Department doesn't give the FBI the authority and the power to further their investigations. If they don't get something investigated within several weeks, they're forced to drop the investigation.
So how do you think this could have played out differently and saved these people's lives?
How? Well, you got to prevent the problem is the extreme. In this case, this was an extreme terrorist who set out to do harm. So you gotta allow the FBI and the Justice Department a little more muscle to put more safeguards in place when they are investigating somebody.
But in this particular instance, the FBI was aware of this guy. They knew he was potentially dangerous. He had never done anything. He was abusive to his wife, which is terrible, but it didn't show that he was going to kill 50 people in a nightclub. What could the FBI have possibly have done for him to make the story end differently?
You know, the FBI could have, well, first off, there could have been charges brought against him for the spousal abuse, the other infractions. He could have had something on it. He could have had some criminal record, some charges put against him where there was some record made where he would not then been able to have got access to the weapon. But because everybody's so tender about how they treat these people, they don't do it. And this is a result of that.
You know what? I disagree respectfully because this is a gun issue because it's called a mass shooting.
Yeah.
So it's without a doubt a gun issue. And because it is, make it so he can't get a weapon.
Right.
Whether it be for falling under the guise of mental illness or on a interview twice by the FBI, make it so you can't get a weapon, an AK-15, because if he didn't have the gun and he went in to cause harm with a dagger or whatever, you know, John, whatever you said.
A firebomb.
I would assume, or I would hazard to guess, that 49 people would not be dead.
No, I'm not disagreeing with that. I agree. He never should have had access to a weapon. But the current State Department is handling all these investigations with kid gloves when they should have more muscle and more enforcement power to when they investigate these people. I mean, the guy was let loose. That's the problem. I mean, there's no enforcement of our current laws that everybody's afraid to make a move because it's not politically correct. Well, you know what? This group of people have pronounced war against our country, and we don't, and that's the problem. It's like we won't name our enemies, so you don't know who to go after. When Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, they rounded up 150,000 Japanese-American citizens and held them in detention camps. Today, nothing like that would even be considered. And that's the problem, because these people are living among us.
Well, also because everyone thinks that was the wrong thing to do.
Right.
The internment camps were everyone at this point, everyone agrees.
That's your opinion, but you know what?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much universally accepted it was the wrong thing to do.
Yeah.
That's your opinion. When Pearl Harbor blew up, people reacted. They were scared, and we're scared, and everybody's scared. Nothing's being done about it.
All right, John. We appreciate the call. Thanks, John.
Mm-hmm. All right.
That comparison, you know, I did hear that yesterday as well. And, Steve, I'm glad you jumped in with that, too. I did hear that yesterday, and I thought that's so not only is it a different time, but it's so vastly different. I don't think you can compare.
Oh, no way.
The two.
But with this guy, like even his own father says, and his father's something of a piece of work, by the way, too.
Oh, how about it? Right?
I've been reading things that his father has said, including God himself will punish homosexuality. Mm-hmm. He was saying, you know, his son shouldn't have done what he did, but it's up to God to decide what to do with homosexuals. What does that tell you about his dad?
He's had some crazy YouTube rants, too.
Yeah,
I think he was a few sandwiches short of a picnic.
But with his dad is trying to say that this had little, if anything, to do with religion. This had more to do with the fact that he was uncomfortable with gay people, which is a whole nother problem. I mean, no matter how you slice it, this guy was a ticking time bomb. There's just no way to prevent him from exploding until he explodes.
Yeah, completely.
It's incredible. All right, we need to take a break. Thank you, everybody, for chiming in. We will certainly talk more about this throughout the show, not exclusively, but it'll come up again. Trust me, 312-981-7200. You already know the phone number. We'll take a quick break. Steve with the news and then more. It's Bill Leff and Andre Darla sitting in for Wendy on WGN. Steve, thanks very much. It's Bill Leff along with Andrea Darlis. Andrea is sitting in for Wendy, who will return tomorrow. On the phone line with us is Tom Mikitis. Tom is a professor of history at DePaul University right here in Chicago and a terrorism analyst here to discuss some of what we'll be talking about. Here to discuss what happened yesterday. But he's not on the line quite yet, Kevin. We still loading him up? Okay. We'll give it just a minute or two. One of the things I want to ask him, because I'm very unclear on this, but it came up yesterday while I was watching the various news sources, is they were trying to determine whether or not what happened was a hate crime, an act of terrorism, or both.
Or both.
And I'm not positive I know what the differentiation is between those.
Yeah, we'll have to ask.
He's on, Kevin. He's good.
Oh, good.
Tom, thank you for being here. I just introduced you, of course, a professor of history at DePaul, terrorism expert. We do appreciate your time on this, Tom. I just said to Andrea, what is the difference? They were trying to determine yesterday if this was a hate crime or an act of terrorism or potentially both. Do we know the difference in those classifications?
Well, I mean, you know, acts of terrorism are almost by definition hate crime. But in this case, when you focus on a particular marginalized group, typically the Islamists have been content with, prefer mass casualty events directed at the general population of the United States. This, however, was a more focused attack on a group of individuals, although I think we all need to say an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us. But he targeted this particular group. I also think there's a personal pathology going on here, not more so than even a terrorist ideology.
Tom, this is in no way criticizing the response of the Orlando Police Department, but I'm just curious, what are the procedures and the protocol for it? It took them several hours to respond and to move in. Why is that? Can you kind of explain
that? I can tell you that. And the thing is, and I think you're right not to criticize them, we don't know the full details of the situation. The wisdom in any kind of hostage situation has typically been, as long as there's no shooting going on, the individual is wanting to negotiate, you basically contain and hold and then do that negotiation. Because the object is at that point is to get as many people, including the shooter, ironically, out of the situation alive. So they were talking to him, and if he's talking, he's not shooting. So I think what they probably determined is, again, they don't know, they don't have eyes inside the place. So what they were probably doing was having a conversation with him. They said that, and that he was calm and things like that, they claim. But on the other hand, he wasn't clear what he was asking for either. Now, something must have changed. There must have been something that led them to believe that either he was about to fire again, or who knows, he may have been fired. We don't know. But they then decided they had to go in and accept the risk to the hostages by storming the place. So I'm not an expert on SWAT tactics, but on the other hand, everything I've seen says that they handled it as well as they could have.
Tom, you alluded just a few seconds ago to what he may or may not have been asking for. That's usually a component in a situation like this. There's some sort of demands, right?
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. The thing is, this is so reminiscent to me of Anders Breivik in Norway. Because you have an individual who's clearly appears to be disturbed, latching on to an ideology. Same thing happened in Colorado Springs with the man who went in with another AR-15 to a Planned Parenthood clinic, and was rambling about no more dead babies. But on the other hand, clearly was clinically disturbed. So I think that's going on here. If you look at his photos that he's tweeting and his behaviors, no sign of increased religiosity, no increased devotion, no growing a beard, he seems, and his ex-wife was saying not only was he abusive, but he was abusive in an erratic kind of way. She didn't know, why he would hit her and things of that, apparently. And his family said, we didn't see any signs of being more religious. The mosque said, we don't have any real contact with him on this. So I really think this is driven by his own internal kind of dynamic. And he happened, obviously, as a Muslim, he focused on that particular radical ideology and made that the lightning rod.
So, Tom, we were questioning beforehand, and I think since the beginning, when we found out that the FBI had questioned him twice and didn't find enough information or enough credibility to put him on a, quote, watch list, how come? I mean, what has to constitute?
I don't know. Yeah, that's a question I've been fielding all morning. Yeah, and I don't really know what exactly he said. unhealthy interest in, and I think that's what it was. It was about comments he was making. They might have determined, and again, there's a certain, I'm speculating here, you know, that his activity online was disturbing and so on. But unless he's crossed the line, or unless, you know, and again, they have a lot of people they got to watch, you know, unless he's crossed a particular line, met a certain threshold, you know, they must have made their determination. Now, when they do this twice, I'm very leery. And I don't think there was connection between that and the abuse of the spouse. Now, there was no charge in the abuse of the spouse, but there was still a report. But I'm kind of wondering if somebody had put all those pieces together, at the very least, they might have been able to say, you know what, you can't have a gun until we do a more thorough background check. Unfortunately, the watch list and the FBI investigation is federal. All the gun laws in you know, of this kind are state to state, and that's a huge problem.
Tom, they made mention, the ex-wife did anyway, at her press conference, that when she first met him and in the early stages of their relationship, he was extremely normal, and then there was some sort of a switch that flipped, and he became a much more hot-tempered person. Is that something that's majorly significant in this case, do you think?
You'd have to ask a mental health expert, but that's indicative. I think what she herself used the word bipolar, and I'm not qualified to make that determination. But as I look at all the pieces, this suggests a personal pathology, not a typical ISIS thing. Now, what's confusing is his profile: first generation, born in the U.S., you know, Afghani parents, you know, not being sort of in this kind of no man's land. But on the other hand, the evidence was he had a good job. He worked for a security firm. He seems to have developed this healthy relationship, and then something changed. Now, again, you should talk to somebody in the mental health field and ask him, is this typical of a personality disorder, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder? I'm not qualified to say that. But the point is, all of the signs are pointing to something going on in his head rather than his what we call the typical radicalization, where he's becoming more devout, and at some point somebody latches on to him and radicalizes him by persuading him that, well, you really need to join. It's not enough to be devout. You have to join this organization, strike a blow on behalf of the cause. That doesn't seem to have happened.
Tom, you study this, you analyze this, and I don't mean this to be a morbid question, but I think it's just the society in which we live today. Mm-hmm. If we're ever in a situation, God forbid, you know, in somewhere we think is a safe zone and something happens, should we run? Do we hide? Or I know there's a lot of people who might want to try and play hero and take the suspect down. What are we encouraged to do?
You know, that's not a morbid question. That's a healthy question, and I really wish more people would ask it, because there are things you can do. There's something called shelter in place. I go through it with my students in a classroom. I'm not trying to scare you, but here's what we're going to do in the event that I get an announcement of an active shooter, that shelter in place is the thing you do until you're sure you can move safely. That's what the people in the bathroom did. You know, it means staying low, staying out of sight, putting your phone on vibrate. This is not the time to be tweeting your friends, hey, I'm in the middle of a shootout. Isn't this cool? Not a good idea. You don't want to, and they're going to try to call you. So if you've got, don't have your phone on vibrate. You don't want to turn it off, because you might be able to get information out. But if it's going to ring, it just draws attention to you. So, you know, if you can't actually get out through the exits, as some people did, you know, finding a safe place, being, you know, down and low and quiet, you know, not drawing attention to yourself is something you could do. And as I said, there were two bathrooms, and one of them were about 20 people who survived, precisely because somehow, I don't know if they barricaded themselves or they just hid, they managed to. Okay. It's a case-by-case thing, you know, running, you know, if you can get away, if you know somebody coming in one door and you're going out the other, that might work. In other cases, you don't know whether you're actually, if you don't know where the shooter is, and that's not a particularly good strategy, because you could be running right in to the target area. In this case, the people were wise who got out the back, but not everybody can. I mean, there's only so many doors, even in a fire safe code, in which it sounds like this was a pretty safe environment, and there was a guard at the door. You know, it's just, there's no such thing as absolute security. But that's a really, that people need to think about that more. Be aware of your surroundings.
I know this is an extreme, but I'd be afraid in that barricading myself in a bathroom situation that you could potentially hear people on the outside wanting to come in and join you, and then you're thinking, do I know that this is legit? Could this possibly be the shooter? Who do I let in? Who do I not let in? There's so much happening in such a quick burst of time.
And I can't answer that question. It's a case-by-case, individual-by-individual situation that you would just have to assess to the best of your knowledge.
Tom, there's other questions that we have for you. Are you okay on time? Do you have a couple more minutes with us?
I'm fine. No, yeah, I have no time pressure at all.
Tom Mikitas is with us, professor of history at DePaul University right here in Chicago, and a terrorism analyst. If you have any questions or comments, 312-981-7200. It's Bill F. and Andre Darla sitting in for Wendy on WGN. Tom Mikitas is our guest. It's Bill F. and Andrea Darla sitting in for Wendy Snyder. Tom is a professor of history at DePaul University right here in Chicago and a terrorism analyst. Tom, here's a question that I brought up earlier with Andrea and with Steve Bertrand in the newsroom. As of yesterday, on ISIS's webpage, they made mention of the events that took place in Orlando, but they didn't fully claim the events. They just made mention of them. How is this advantageous or not for them?
Well, they're going to mention and bless any attack of this style, and if it's to their, it's always to their advantage to claim that they're behind it, even because, of course, they want us to believe they can hit us whenever, wherever they choose, which is not the case. And so, if you're, and the other is, they welcome fellow travelers. You don't have to be a formal member. You strike a blow in the interest of the cause, we'll celebrate it. So, you know, this is grist for their mill. There's no question about that. Their targeting has been, you know, not, it's interesting. ISIS is not targeted symbolically in the sense of they have not, like, say, targeted a gay nightclub or something like that. The concert venue in Paris was just a target because it had a large concentration of people in a very compacted space, a confined space, and made it much easier to kill them. Same with the soccer stadium. But this, that's why I say this guy seemed to have gotten really upset about this. Just someone in his family said he'd seen two men kissing and he got very angry at it and so on. But that seems to be what was going on here.
It doesn't seem like ISIS really cares who dies as long as people die.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, with the Paris.
Yeah.
With the Paris nightclub.
Yeah, exactly. That's the bitter irony of religiously motivated terrorism. You know, kill them all, let God sort them out. I mean, during the way back in 1998, Al-Qaeda, some of the captured people from the Tanzania bombing in East Africa, the Twin Embassy bombings, they interviewed the guy and they said, didn't you know that because of all the Muslim you know, employees, civilian employees, that you'd kill a lot of them too? He goes, oh, yeah, we were told that. But if they were in the right relationship with God, they'd go to paradise. If not, you know, they'd suffer the consequences. Well, if that's your mentality, there simply is no moderation. They just, you know, we've seen what they do on to what they've done to their prisoners, the massacre of, you know, the murder and rape of Yazidis, the murder of the Shia. I mean, there just is no moderation. But again, I think this is something personally set this guy off and focused him on this target.
Tom, I know that as we speak, investigators are trying to determine exactly what part he, the shooter, played in any terrorist group. So once we have that information, whether he is fully invested in a terrorism group or not, what do we do with that information?
Yeah, the thing is that this is something, you know, when I started working on counterterrorism for, you know, through the U.S. government, actually, I've been studying it long before, but around 2002, we were very focused on you destroy the group, you degrade the organization, you eliminate the leaders, this kind of decapitation operations, you know, you contain their ability to operate. We're now much more focused on countering radicalization, saying, let's try and figure out what attracts people to organizations and then see if we can counter it. And the thing there, of course, is you think in, you know, in kind of inoculation terms, who's the vulnerable population and how do we vaccinate them? And part of that means, you know, getting with educators, leaders in religious communities, family members, you know, counselors, everybody to say, much as we would with a person with an alcohol or drug abuse problem, hey, we need to do an intervention here. They've done some of that in the Twin Cities with the Somali population. There was a man who returned from ISIS, an American man. It was on TV. I think it was Channel 5 a couple weeks back. And they're using him to try and he said, hey, it's not what I thought it was. You know, guy, and they use that information, put it out on the web, say, hey, look, you're being lied to. But the other is they interview him and say, help us understand how you got hooked, and so we can get in there and counter it. you know, because a lot of it takes place, you know, there's a human contact, but it's often through, you know, encrypted means on the web. It may be their equivalent of Skype or Google Hangouts and so on, as well as through dark websites and chat rooms. And we're trying to figure that out and kind of get in there and interdict it.
Tom, we appreciate your knowledge on this, your expertise on this. Really quick, because we only have a couple of seconds, did anything about you, other than the obvious that 50 people died and 53 more were injured, did anything just out and out shock you about what went down yesterday?
Even when I do this, I don't completely lose the ability to be shocked. I was, you know, struck by the extent of it, as you said. And then the more that emerged, in a very odd sort of way, I was a bit relieved, because it does not have the hallmarks of Brussels, San Bernardino, or Paris. Does not appear to be a sophisticated plot. This appears to be a random actor, a lone wolf, acting out of a pathology that latched onto an ideology and focuses anger in a particular direction. Strange as it may seem, horrific as it is, it does mean that we don't look to see a bunch of, you know, of a cell of people trying to do the same thing. We worry about copycats, but right, not people directly connected to him.
Tom, again, we appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time today. It's Tom Mikaitis, professor of history at DePaul University here in Chicago and a terrorism analyst. We'll take a quick break, and then the news from Kim Gordon. It's Bill and Andrea in for Wendy on WGN. Kim, thanks so much. It's Bill F. and Andrea Darlis filling in for the vacationing Wendy Snyder. Wendy will be back tomorrow. This is the time where we welcome our favorite Tribune columnist, certainly the most feisty of all, Eric Zorn. Hello, Eric. How are you? Hold on, Andrea. Wait, let me turn. There you go.
Oh, okay, I'll say that again. Better. Nice to see you, Bill. Nice to see you, Andrea. you know, I've been on Morning Joe on MSNBC.
Yeah.
They always introduce Mike Barnicle as the legendary columnist. And I'm thinking, maybe I chose the wrong adjective.
No. I think feisty is more respectful. Respectable.
People would fear you more.
Yeah. Legendary, too.
There you go.
Yeah. See,
but that goes without saying.
That validates
me. It'd be embarrassing to even say that.
You know, you know how high maintenance I am.
So. Right. Extremely high maintenance. Yesterday, there were two different shows that I watched that were meant as entertainment shows, but because of what happened in Orlando, Florida, they had to make mention of it. So both at the Tony Awards and then later on John Oliver's show on HBO, they each took a moment or so to recognize what happened and to explain that they're operating under difficult circumstances, especially John Oliver, who said, look, we're just doing a dumb comedy show. We wrote a bunch of silly jokes and we're going to do them. But believe me when I tell you, we're respectful of what happened.
Yeah. Although John Oliver's show is, I think, very serious. I mean, it's funny, but he takes some serious topics and really goes after them.
Right.
And I assume he will probably be able to do that with this topic in a few weeks.
Yeah.
I saw that cold opening of the Oliver show and it was,
very effective. And it did, you know, what it did was perfect, was it says we're all aware of what happened and we're not trying to ignore it. But this is stuff that we spent all week writing and it's not as important as what happened. But just give us our due time on this, you know. So
it's almost like a moment of silence at something, a ball game or something before it actually starts.
I think everybody is just feeling this helplessness about things like this. And one of the things that we had a long conversation at the Tribune editorial board this morning, sort of saying, well, what can we do about this? What should we have done about this? What laws could have been in place that could have stopped this incident in Orlando? And it's very frustrating. I read a pretty interesting interview with a guy named Jeffrey Simon, who's written a book called Lone Wolf Terrorism, Understanding the Growing Threat.
We're currently working on having him on in the second half of today's show.
Oh, yeah. You are? Well, yeah. Then I don't want to give away too much.
No, you can.
It was a really interesting interview. We talked a lot about how the internet enables and encourages people to do this, and it allows groups like ISIS to have these spectacular events and get all the credit for them without spending any money or using any of their organizational structure to attack the target and to claim this great victory for them. And at the end of the interview, they said, well, so, you know, what can we do about this? He goes, well, this is a very difficult problem, and it's very hard to talk about because there really isn't much you can do when you have something, you know, like the 9/11 attacks, where you've got this structure in place and they're funding it and they're training people and there's like chatter going on and people have to communicate. You've got some chance of picking up on the stuff that's in the air,
right,
what's going on with these people. But when it's one crazy guy,
right,
who is licensed to carry a gun. I mean, he was a security guard.
I know.
The Orlando perpetrator. He was a security guard. He wasn't, you know, he had undergone a deeper background check than a normal person would have undergone. And he is sitting in his home stewing and festering about having seen two men kissing, and he hatches a plot like this. I know we don't know everything yet about what had happened here, but it doesn't seem to anybody that this is the kind of thing that he was directed to do, or ordered to do, or this was part of some sort of coordinated effort, that he just did this on his own. He invented it on his own. He answered the call. There was a call from al-Baghdadi, I believe it was maybe a month ago, saying that people who are supporters of ISIS during the month of Ramadan needed to make sure that they you perpetrated these kind of attacks. So
what was interesting, didn't you think, Bill, is that when Tom Mikaitis was on just a little while ago with us, and he almost looked at that, the fact that he was a lone wolf, as a bit of a silver lining, not that you could look at anything positive that comes out of this.
Totally,
yeah,
right.
I kind of did too, but Mikaitis thought that was, you know, it's not part of this larger plot, you know, that's going to be carried out at gay clubs all across the country or in certain locations, but that it was isolated. And yeah, I kind of mixed emotions on that too.
But how do you combat that? I mean, we were talking in the meeting about, and I'm not sure, actually, I couldn't tell you what they concluded if I knew, but I know that they didn't come to a conclusion yet about what else we can say about what to do here. Because, you know, it seems like after every one of these events, like Newtown or Virginia Tech or Aurora, or Fort Hood, or all these places, you sort of look back and go, well, what could we have done to stop that one? And this is a particularly difficult one because, I mean, the guy was interviewed by the FBI. The one suggestion that I made.
More than once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one suggestion I made is that if you rise to that level of someone who has been interviewed by the FBI, who is on the radar screen, that maybe every time you buy weapons, that not that you're forbidden from buying weapons, not that you lose your rights, but that the alarm bells go off.
I completely agree. Like, yeah. There should be an asterisk.
I mean, this guy
there.
Went and he was. They questioned him twice. He had said some wacky things. They determined that he wasn't enough of a threat to put a tail on him or to be reading his email and so on. Because I mean, they can't. I mean, the idea that we would be able to do that for all the people who rise to that level is impossible. You can't. We don't have enough law enforcement. We don't have enough money to follow everybody around. But when someone like that goes and buys an assault weapon and the ammunition and so on. I heard somewhere that he tried to buy some body armor and things like that.
Right.
And when that happens, somebody ought to be alerted, and it ought to be sort of automatic. So the FBI says, hey, this guy we talked to 2 years ago, we didn't think he was that much of a problem, but now he's seems to be taking it another step. Let's check back in with him.
Think about when you buy a car or a home. You know, just take a car, because I bought a car about a year and a half ago. You know, it literally took a couple of days to go through the paperwork. They have to go through your financing and your check your credit score. I mean, there's a process that goes through it.
And that's for a car.
That's for a car. Same for a home. I mean, you have to get the loan and the credit and go through hoops, except if you go through David Hochberg, of course. But I mean, but you know what I mean, though, Eric? There has to be some sort of a process where maybe if you want to buy an AK-15 or an assault weapon, now that it's, you know, been used, the precedent's been set, it's already been used in at least three other mass shootings or massacres, if you will, there should be, you're right, a light that goes on that says, okay, you know what? This guy's been talked to twice. He's going to buy an AK-15. Let's do another, whatever the next level would be.
Swing by and talk to him again, see what's going on. Of course, then you get places like Boston. Every time someone buys a pressure cooker, you know, you got to check in with them. I mean, it's these kind of things. And I think the Sarnaev brothers, we've discovered, these are the guys in Boston who set off the bombs at the Boston Marathon. I don't think there was any real chatter about that, because it wasn't a coordinated plan. That was their idea, and they pulled it off on their own. So how do you stop that? But there, it seems to me that there are steps you can take, at least to sort of make sure that more red flags are popping up. Now, the problem, it's politically difficult, because anytime you talk about registering people or putting people into databases when it comes to firearms, you're going to get a huge pushback.
Of course.
I'm not someone who's like a crazy gun grabber, and he says, I believe in that. Guns are good for people to have for self-protection if they want them. I'm fine with that. But I think that we do need to keep the kind of stuff that Andrea's talking about, where you keep track of who buys guns, where they are, and you know, the idea of having a database of gun owners and keeping track of how they're moving around, that is anathema to the National Rifle Association. They think that is one step away from the government turning a switch and confiscating all of them.
But all that said, and we discussed this, Andrea said this at the top of the show, how many people would have to be on a list of saying, this guy or this girl is potentially dangerous. We work with him and he has said some awful things. I'm his ex-wife and he has threatened people. How many people would be on that list before they would take action? You know, if you were the guy being denied a firearm, you get a lawyer to argue the fact that the Constitution says until you've done something.
Yes, and that's true. And I think you couldn't actually say, no, you can't buy a weapon. I think that you would have to. All it would do is it'd be raise a red flag. It would be like, if this guy had been on, you know, the top of the radar screen for the FBI last week, maybe they would have seen something going on. They would have intervened. They would have gone to talk to him. They would have said, this isn't sounding right. Maybe they could have said that. I mean, that's all I can come up with. I don't know what else, because you can't. He happened to use an assault weapon, or the military style assault weapon, but semi-automatic. But Virginia Tech, the guy who killed, what, he killed 35 people?
He used
handguns. So people say, let's get rid of assault weapons. And that might do some good. It might deter some people. But, you know, maybe one thing that the editorial board has come out against before are these large magazines, these large ammunition clips.
Yeah.
Maybe make those smaller. That makes it a little more difficult. The person has to reload more often. That seems like a very small improvement, but maybe you have to take those incremental steps. But even those kind of things, you get a lot of pushback. So it is one of the most frustrating topics, because every time you start thinking, well, how could you stop that? And then you think, well, that's not the kind of country we live in.
Right.
Which is why some of the stuff that Donald Trump has been saying about this, you know, in the wake of it is so kind of scary, because I feel like his pitch is going to be, I'm going to violate all of our principles except the Second Amendment in order to crack down on this.
I know.
That appeals to some people, because there is a sense like, what can we do? Well, maybe we can take away the rights of people who are Muslims or something like that. It was
curious to me that his attack yesterday on the president, Donald Trump's, was that he didn't want to use the word radical in describing what happened in Orlando or similar incidents.
Well, he didn't want to use the term Islamic. I think that was the...
Right. Well, yeah, but... He used the term, I know he said radical. I'm trying to remember if he said radical Islamists or Islam in his speech today.
Obama?
Yeah.
I didn't hear his speech today. I haven't heard it yet.
I think you're right. I think he said radicalized.
He did say radicalized.
Yeah,
that's the way he worded it.
He did say radicalized.
Right.
Yeah, he didn't say radical Islam.
But why is that such an issue, those particular words? Why does that upset Donald Trump so much?
It plays into people's sense that there is some sort of a political correctness that is preventing us from taking the steps that we need to take in the Middle East and domestically to deal with this problem.
Yeah.
And that if we don't identify Islam as the problem, then we're not going to be able to appropriately fight it. I don't think that's true, and I think, in fact, that when you gratuitously start trying to lump it all together and to blame Islam for this rather than these radical sects, this radical organization, you end up sort of inflaming the tensions in the Islamic world in general. You end up polarizing people there, and I think this isn't any kind of sensitivity on my part that makes me say it. I think it's just as a practical matter,
right?
You make things worse. You inflame these tensions. You increase the chances that somebody's going to decide they're going to go out and shoot people up when you keep lumping in and insulting their religion. And I mean, I just think it's not smart. And you know, they talk, obviously, at the highest levels of security about what the right words to use, you know, are and how to proceed. So they're not, it's not like Obama saying, well, I can't say that he was Islamic because, and you say maybe he did, but I can't say that because it's going to offend people. No, I think that's not it at all. I think that they are thinking strategically. So I reject this idea like, oh, he's afraid to say radical Islamic terror. He can't name the enemy. I think there's a price to be paid when you name the enemy. So I think they're moving as cautiously as I can, trying to prevent something from happening. And, you know, we got to worry about the Pride Parade here in Chicago next week.
Yeah.
It's a huge soft target. You know,
sure.
A long parade with lots and lots of people there. And so, you know, those things are very scary. And you can't protect all our soft targets. You can stop people as they go into Wrigley Field. You can check people when they're going into various arenas. But, you know, especially in the summer in the city, there's people everywhere.
Yeah, of course. Right. Yep. Eric Zorn is here from the Chicago Tribune. Stick around. We've got more ahead. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. It's Bill Leff and Andrea Darlison for Wendy Snyder on WGN. Thanks, Andrea. It's Bill Leff, along with Andrea Darlis, sitting in for Wendy Snyder for the first half. Mike Toomey will be by in the second half. Eric Zorn is here from the Chicago Tribune. Other things are going on, certainly, in the world, Eric, but one in particular that has gotten your goat, I remember you had a goat, and it's been gotten, is something that's happening with people's speech patterns. Please explain.
I can't find my goat.
Where's your goat?
Someone got it. The thing that really has been bothering me lately is this habit of, that some people have of turning every statement they have into a question. Have you noticed this? Either of you noticed this? Where someone...
I think I know what you're referring to. Yeah.
So it'll be this thing where they'll be talking and they'll be asking you about, and they won't, but they won't actually be asking a question. They'll be making a statement.
Yeah.
Like, and it gets, it's like a tick. It's this conversational tick. Some people are bothered by other conversational, you know, things that people throw into their speech patterns. But this one is just driving me nuts. And I pulled out, I have a 1 minute clip I sent to Kevin. And this is like a well-educated guy. He's on the Vox podcast called The Weeds.
Yeah.
And if you just listen to this 1 minute and listen to how many, he doesn't ask a single question, but everything he says is in the, it has that little up.
So at the end of his sentence, instead of going down as you would normally do to end a sentence, it's more of an inquisitive.
And he's a really smart guy. This is not about like, you know, someone is dumb saying this.
Right.
It's just this tick, and apparently it's unshakable. Can we listen to that?
Yeah, here it goes.
It reminds me a little bit of charter school debates, where I think you have a lot of examples of, particularly in states where it's really hard to start a charter school, of some really good ones. But then in states where you make it easy, you know, when you have like lots and lots and lots, it's like the marginal one is often not that great, because you have like a number of people who like have a good idea and a good motivation and like want to run these schools or want to work in them. And like, it's a real thing. But then there's only so many to go around. And like, by the same token, right, it's like, this could be a great opportunity for a handful of like visionary healthcare entrepreneurs. But healthcare is this super labor intensive, not highly scalable sort of business where you can't just like copy and paste the best hospital in America into every single city. And we're having some trouble like even articulating what is working well in the places that are doing really well. It's not like obvious how to repeat the success.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
You found the Barry Bonds of up talking. That guy ended every sentence that way.
He had some good points.
I think he was good at what he does.
I don't understand where that comes from. I mean, this guy, I don't think he's insecure at all. He's clearly one of the top, you know, pundits in the country.
Sure.
35 years old, so he's not a young guy.
Yeah.
And I don't get it. And I hear it a lot. And he's not the only one by any means. I hear this a lot from people. And I just was wondering where this comes from. And I was trying to get practitioners of it to tell me, like, why they do this. Why is everything like that?
Wait, are you brave enough to find a guy like this? Like, if you heard a guy speaking in that manner, would you be brave enough to say, hey, I'm curious, I noticed this about your speech pattern, why do you talk that way?
He did respond to me on Twitter once when I raised this issue. He's like, this is the way I talk, get over it. And
is that what he said?
Yeah, so maybe I'll ask him again about this.
I mean, the thing about it is
I think that he makes really good points. I think that, I mean, he's a very smart guy. And if you try to listen, I think it's impossible to listen to that and figure out what he's saying, because it's so distracting.
I have a friend who's very, very intelligent, and she will end most of her statements with, you know. So she'll make a great point and say, you know, as though to say, right?
Like, right,
she,
yeah.
Maybe, listen, maybe sure. They need the affirmation.
Well, this is what I've heard, is that it's one of the things, they go along and you're just trying to make sure that people are nodding.
Oh, yeah.
And like, Bill, as I'm talking here, are you listening to me? Are we tracking?
And you're not.
I'm not.
He's totally checked
an Archie
out.
Comic
he's
book.
Watching these people walk by outside. But I thought I'd raise that as something that people should be aware of when they. And I wonder, do these people ever listen to themselves on a recording, or do they ever have anybody tell them, like, you know what, that's really annoying.
Yeah.
And it undercuts what you're saying. So I'm urging people to do that. The thing that really bothers some other people, by the way, just if we're on to conversation things, is called vocal fry. Have you heard about that?
I don't know what vocal fry is.
It's a thing where you end a sentence and your voice kind of cracks at the end.
And oh, who does that?
Apparently, a lot of young women do it, and this
really?
Is a big issue. Vocal fry, yeah, and even like Ira Glass is said to do it.
Yeah,
it's this whole thing that people learn to talk this way. I don't even notice it when people do it. So it may be some, maybe other people don't notice
it. It doesn't affect you, but other people are bothered by it.
Speaking of questions, look who's here.
Steve Bertrand is here. He's the host of the Wintrust Business Line.
But his main gig is as on the Mincing Rascals podcast.
Yes,
on
of course.
WGN Plus every week.
We're well aware of that.
Kristen McQuarrie and John. John, what's John's last name?
John Williams.
John Williams is also on there.
Yesterday, yeah.
We have to take a break, and then we'll find out what Steve has on his show. But thank you. Good to see you again. It's been a couple of weeks.
It has been. I'll be back soon.
We'll be back next week with more Eric Zorn. All right. We'll find out what Steve has on the Wintrust Business Lunch in just a little bit. It's Bill Leff and Andrea Darlis in for Wendy on WGN. Oh, thank you so much, Kim. Hi, everybody. It's me, Bill Leff. Wendy Snyder is away for one more day. She's on vacation. Sitting in her chair right now, my friend Mike Toomey. You know Mike is one of the finest stand-ups that this city has ever produced and also a fixture on the WGN TV Morning News where he plays a multitude of characters, including himself. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Hi, Bill.
Thank you very much for
Thank
being
you.
Here.
By the way, that's the least interesting of the characters.
Oh, is it the one that you, that's being you? The, oh, come on.
Me as myself.
I don't know
the
if that's
least
true.
Interesting of the characters.
I don't want to start out your tenure here with some sad news, but there is some sad news from the world of show business. Kim Gordon told Kevin, our producer, this, and I think this is hot breaking news. What do we know about this, Kim? Who have we lost from the world of show business?
Michu Mazeros, and I'm not exactly sure if that's how you say his name, but he played Alf for 4 seasons.
Oh.
He passed away. He was 76. I guess last week he was found unresponsive at his home, and he was in a coma, and he died.
Michu Mazera.
He was the voice of Alf?
I think he was. Was he the voice or the person? I think he was the person inside Elf.
I think he was because he was only 33 inches tall.
Oh,
so that would be it. He was coined unofficially as the smallest man on Earth.
Oh, Michu, the world's smallest man. Yeah. He used to be with the Ringling Brothers Circus.
That's who it was. But he apparently played Alf, I guess, for 4 seasons.
Oh.
Wow.
That's the guy. For some reason, I knew him better as you'd always see whenever the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus would come to town, you'd see those TV ads where they would be hawking what they'd be, and they'd also go, and you could see Michu, the world's smallest man. Mm-hmm. That guy.
Yeah, so apparently he was with Barnum and Bailey Circus in the 70s and then, you know, did the Alf gig in the 80s.
Later on, he was
but
Alf.
But he was also really good friends with Michael Jackson. Did you know that?
Really?
Yeah, he was reportedly a regular at Neverland Ranch.
Oh, wow.
It's not that surprising.
And was present during Michael Jackson's courtship to Lisa Marie.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And were you making the quote signs when you said courtship?
No, the quote signs was for the smallest man on earth. But I guess I could do it for courtship also.
I do it for courtship.
Either one of them are acceptable.
Take your pick.
Yes.
Now, the headline I would have for the passing of Alf would be, this would be my headline if I was drawing up a celebrity sad news. I would just say Alf Wiedersehen.
Yeah, right.
Wouldn't that be that would be appropriate for this?
That's a good way of saying goodbye.
Goodbye to Alf.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and he was born in Hungary, so he probably spoke German.
Oh, maybe. Yeah.
Well,
so it all ties in.
That's perfect.
Well, that's very sad news.
It is sad.
We have lost Alf. Although I don't think I'm positive he did not do the voice.
Sounded like a guy that they would brought in.
Yeah, right.
Auditioned several people.
I'm sure
with the voice for Alf.
Speaking of losing people, you on your Facebook page, Mike, I saw this over the weekend, and I've never done this in my whole life on Facebook. I took what you wrote or the post that you had and then copied it over to my page so more people could be aware of this. You posted Billy Crystal's fine words at the funeral of Muhammad Ali from Friday.
Yeah, astounding.
Wasn't it beautiful?
I mean, yeah, he just had a genuine love for Ali, a genuine friendship for him, and respect for him personally and professionally. It just blew me away, and it was just so reverent, and yet he made people laugh too with the Cosell and the Ali impressions. It was just so good.
It was entertaining.
On every level.
I don't know how you could have done a better eulogy for, and they were close for many many years. He told the story and. Jim Tirano was here on Friday, and we told a version of this too, although if you hear it from Billy Crystal, you're getting it right from the source, about that very first time that Billy Crystal ever appeared on network television. They were doing a roast of Muhammad Ali, and everybody on the board, everybody who was going to speak was famous, most internationally famous, and nobody knew who Billy Crystal was. The only reason he got the job is because his manager convinced them he does a pretty good impression of Muhammad Ali.
I think what he said, they were putting it together and they said, well, there's we need somebody to make us laugh. And he said they went after the funniest guy who did sports comedy, and when he wasn't available, then they
trickled down to him.
Yeah.
But he said it, Billy Crystal said in his eulogy on Friday that even as he was approaching the microphone, Muhammad Ali looked over because he didn't know who Billy Crystal was. And then when it was over and he won the room over like nobody's business, Muhammad Ali just kind of put him around his arm and said, "You're my little brother," right, and stuff. And they were friends from then on.
He said from that day, he was always referred to by Ali
as his little brother.
Yeah.
And he told the story. You know, I've heard this story before, but Billy Crystal told it again on Friday about how one time Muhammad Ali had this routine where he would jog this path along a golf course all the time. Mm-hmm. And he invited Billy Crystal to jog along with him. And he said, "I can't because that golf course is restricted." And Muhammad Ali had no idea what that meant. Mm-hmm. And he explained to him, he's Jewish, he's not allowed there. And he goes, "I'm a Muslim, I'm a black Muslim. They'll let me jog there. They won't let you jog there. I'm never going there again." Mm-hmm. And Billy Crystal said, and he didn't. He never went there again.
Wow.
Which shows his conviction for something when he believes in it. But what a strong 15 minutes.
Yeah. Oh.
If you haven't seen it, it's on your Facebook page, it's on mine, and other people certainly have it as well. You can find it easily. Kevin, there must be some way we can get it on our Facebook page, too. It's Billy Crystal's beautiful last words about Muhammad Ali.
And the story about Cosell's funeral.
Yeah.
He said they're sitting there during the ceremony, and Ali looked at Billy Crystal and said, "Do you think he's wearing his hairpiece?" Because it was a closed casket, and, you know. And Crystal said, "Probably not."
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, how will God recognize him?"
And do you remember the answer?
You say, once he starts talking.
Yeah, they'll know it's him.
Yeah.
It's really funny. It's really funny. We also, the other day, we lost the man that they called Mr. Hockey, Gordie Howe died. And I read something over the weekend that for some reason, when we got news of this on Friday, I thought about this and it just kind of escaped me. In the movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Ferris Bueller's best friend, is it Cameron? Is that who his best friend's name
Cameron.
Is? Cameron is wearing, through most of the movie, a Gordie Howe jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And I and many people who have seen this movie have always said, why would a movie that takes place in Chicago with such fervent sports fans, why would you have a major character wearing a Detroit Red Wings jersey? They're our enemy. That doesn't make sense.
It should be Bobby Hall.
It should be Bobby Hall.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they tracked down the guy who played Cameron, who's been in other things. He's been a working actor. And they said, "Please explain this to us. Why would your character have worn a Gordie Howe jersey in Chicago? It doesn't make any sense." And he told the story that when they wrote the script, and I guess this never made it into the final product, but Cameron was at odds with his dad, if you'll remember. He wrecks his dad's car. He mm-hmm. feels like his dad doesn't really care about him. Well, his dad was a Blackhawks fan, but his grandfather lived in Detroit, and he was a Gordie Howe fan. So he said one of Cameron's ways of getting back at his dad was to wear the other team's jersey.
Sure.
So none of that is really on the screen.
Right.
It's just some backstory. But then it all makes sense.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Maybe they let him put it in the movie.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's why you see Packer jerseys around Chicago.
Sure.
There's always some guy getting back and
hit somebody else.
That's the perfect way to do it.
It is.
Cardinals.
Mike Toomey is here. We've got a big show, a lot coming up. Stick around. If you want to join in, it's easy, 312-981-7200. It's Bill F. along with Mike and for Wendy on WGN. It's me, Bill F. Wendy Snyder is away for one more day. She'll be back tomorrow. Mike Toomey is sitting in for these 2 hours. Mike, we've established in the past what a huge Cubs fan you aren't just now, but you've been for your entire life.
Yes.
Now, last year, as the Cubs were in the playoffs, you and I had a phone conversation, and I said to you, could this possibly be more exciting? They were playing the St. Louis Cardinals at the time.
Yes.
Do you remember what you said to me?
I said, I can't enjoy it. It's too stressful. It's too...
Even though the Cubs were exactly where we wanted them to be in the playoffs against the Cardinals and leading... This does not work. That wasn't working
for
you.
I found myself, like, my kids were excited. We were all sitting around the TV, and it was just like, why am I not enjoying this more? Because never do they get this far, you know? But
I
couldn't. It was just, you know, waiting for that, you know.
Well, you said, and I'll never forget this, you said, I'm so afraid to watch and get involved, and then they will break my heart again. As they've done so many times in the past. And, of course, spoiler alert, they didn't against the Cardinals. The Mets were a different story.
The Mets did it.
But that said, do you have a slightly different feeling this year about the Cubs?
I do. And when we get further in, and if they do get into the postseason, and I say if, I mean, it will revert to that again.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But at this point, it's like, okay, the weekend they lost Friday to the Braves, the worst team in the league.
Yeah.
Never, how do you ever remember being able to say as a Cubs fan, well, they'll probably win the next two.
Right.
They'll win the series.
Right.
Like, I actually found myself thinking that. I wouldn't say it out loud, but never.
Right.
Never, because you don't want to say that, because they're not a team you assume are going to do anything.
Although, it's funny, this year they're the favorite. They're, even before the season started, during the off season,
right,
they were odds-on favorite to win the World Series. If you looked at Las Vegas odds, you just go, that's the same Chicago right. Cubs I've been following my whole life. How could they be the odds-on favorite to take the World Series? Yesterday, of all the stats that I've heard this past season, this was the most interesting to me. In baseball, there's a stat you rarely hear about, and it's blowout wins. And what that means is your team has beaten the other team by a minimum of five runs, five-plus runs. That's a blowout win. Mm-hmm. The Cubs at this point already have, I think they said 23. It's either 22 or 23 this year. All of last year, they had 17, but this year they already have 22 or 23. We're just past the one-third mark on the season. That in and of itself says, and they were saying that the teams that were in second and third place were so distantly
second.
Nobody's close to 22 or 23. No one's close.
The run differential.
Right.
But
here it comes, conditioned
as a Cubs fan, and this is something you know well, the Randy Quaid character
in Major League Two
was the biggest downer. Okay, if something bad's going to happen, it will. Just wait. That was my mom. My mom was like, you know, she wanted them to win. She had the greatest love-hate relationship with the Cubs. Like, she would say, they're going to blow it. Just wait till the ninth. Wait till they're going to blow. She would always wait for them to blow it. So it was almost to be like, well, I wasn't happy, but I was right.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. And then they'd win in a blowout. You'd be like, hey, did you see that, Mom? The Cubs won 14-2. Yeah, tomorrow they'll lose 1-0. Like, always just waiting.
But because of what I call Cub culture, because we've been so conditioned to expect the worst, where the rain clouds come. I know it's sunny, but the rain cloud is coming. I understand and appreciate that, don't you?
It always ends with a loss.
Right.
You know, no matter how far they get. It ends with them losing something.
The other day they got back one of their favorites from last year, Chris Coughlin. Mm-hmm. They were able to get him back from the Oakland A's. If they were able to get back any Cub of any era, who would it be?
Wow. Based on what they might need now?
Yeah. Or based on just a funny name.
Oh, Paul Popovich.
I would want Paul Popovich.
John Bacabella would be good. Adolfo Phillips.
Right. They would be great. Yeah, they would be great. I would want Carmen Fanzone back, because not only do you get his talents at third base,
you get the trumpet.
He'd play the trumpet for you before the game if you want.
Or Dwight Smith.
Dwight Smith.
A great singer. Could sing the national anthem for you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Or Willie Smith.
Right.
Did a pinch home run in
69. I remember. For some reason, they just showed, who was the guy on the Cubs? We're going back maybe 10 or 15 years. Who was the guy on the Cubs who hit the ball not just out of the park but onto the roof across the street?
It was Glenn Allen Hill.
Glenn Allen Hill.
Yeah.
I just saw that footage. It was the anniversary of him hitting that home run over the weekend, and they measured it at 490-something feet, but realistically it was well into the 500s.
Realistically, it hasn't come down yet.
Can I throw Joe Wallace's name in
there? Tarzan Joe Wallace.
Tarzan Joe Wallace.
Why not?
The center field wall.
You know what's funny? They showed that. There was a clip that they made, you know, as a joke of a... I don't know if you remember this, Mike, but they made this little film of a routine fly ball, and as it was pointed out by Steve, he opens the gate and goes outside and then catches it on the other side. Everyone I know has seen that, and I don't think they've shown it since 1983.
It was a precursor to the Griffey. Remember they did one of that with Griffey where he was like running across the continents to catch the ball?
Yeah.
It really Tarzan was. Joe. I mean, everybody rips off Tarzan Joe.
I know. So realistically, they get to the first round of the playoffs. Mm-hmm. You think they go all the way, or you think they get closer than last year? What do you think?
Well, see, that's the thing about the postseason. You know, you get to the postseason, everybody's 0-0.
Yes.
And sometimes you got that team that's really hot going in.
Yes.
And then that becomes the favorite. Remember the Rockies in 07?
Mm-hmm.
Colorado Rockies were like, I don't know, 6-7 games out with less than 2 weeks to play. And they just ran the table. They won their like last 12 regular season games, swept through the postseason.
Right.
And then got to the World Series and got swept by the Red Sox.
But on the other side of that, the year that the last time the White Sox won the World Series, they went limping the last week or 10 days of the season. They looked horrendous, and they just barely
Indians
made the playoffs.
Had them on the ropes, yep.
And then they only lost one game in the playoffs and World Series combined. So you know,
unpredictable.
It's too unpredictable. All right, we're getting a lot of text. 708 demands, doesn't just want, but demands that Johnny Callison be back in a Cubs uniform.
I would like to that see
that. That would be all right. 209 says, I feel the exact same way. I can't get into the Cubs. I'm afraid, and I don't want to be disappointed. The thing is, usually I would agree with that, but they are on pace to have one of the best seasons
at this point,
record-wise. I think Seattle holds the record, right?
Yeah, in 2001, the Cubs were the fastest team to 40 wins since the 2001 Mariners, and that was the stacked.
And were the Mariners? Did they end up 60 games over or 70 games over?
They won 115.
They won 115 games.
Yeah, Lou Piniella was managing.
So we're on pace to challenge that.
But they didn't go all the way. I mean, they got blown out in the playoffs.
Right,
the
Yankees, they did.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
Yep.
You have that kind of season, and then you're stopped in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. Well, we're all hoping for the best. We would all love to see it. I don't want my time on the planet to end without seeing at least one championship over there.
That's what you think. Anytime someone really old dies, that person never
he didn't get
saw
to see it.
The Cubs win the World Series.
Because sometimes, because you could be 104 and die and go, they
never.
Made it to 104 and they didn't see it.
Or you could say that person was the reason.
Right. There's that.
It was a jinx.
That's true. Mike Toomey is sitting in for Wendy. Wendy will be back tomorrow. We're going to take a quick break. Steve with the news and then a lot more show coming your way. It's Bill F. along with Mike Toomey on WGN. Steve, thank you very much. It's me, Bill Laff, along with my friend Mike Toomey. You know him from the WGN-TV Morning News. Mike is filling in for Wendy Snyder, who will be back tomorrow. And sitting across from us, one of our all-time favorite guests, noted pet expert Steve Dale. Hello, Steve. How are you?
I am good. How are you?
Fine. You just told Mike and I something. We didn't have time to discuss it, so why not do it now? You just saw one of my idols and Mike's idols last night.
Yeah. He is still so funny. I'm talking about Mel Brooks. He was at the Chicago Theater. It was a sold-out show. You know, sometimes I don't keep up with things if they're outside the realm of dogs and cats. Mm-hmm. I know everything going on at the dog park and events going on when I'll talk about an animal care and control. But I sometimes lose track of what goes on in the city because there's so much happening in Chicago. And just realized about a week ago that Mel Brooks was coming to town. So I sent my wife, bless her, to the internet. And I said, please try to get tickets. And she did, and she got them, and they were really good seats. Who knew?
Good.
We just lucked out. Totally lucked out. I feel so privileged to have been in the same building. We saw the first thing he did was a screening of Blazing Saddles. And I hadn't seen that movie in, 20 years? And you know what? The laughs are still there.
Yeah.
It's still as outrageous. It's still as offensively funny as it was then.
It's more now.
It is. They never could have made the movie.
I don't think so.
And Brooks said that. So Mel Brooks comes out to do a Q&A with a moderator. First, the moderator comes out, introduces himself, talks for about 20 seconds or so about Mel Brooks. Then Mel Brooks comes out. Everyone stands and applauds, of course, for several minutes. He thanks everyone. There's a chair right behind him. The moderator is sitting in the chair. The moderator, it was 30 minutes in before the moderator said, can I ask a question? Brooks sits down, listens to the question, pops right back up, and begins launching into all these other stories. He's 90 years old.
Yeah.
I want that energy tomorrow, let alone, you know, I mean, really, he's quite incredible in so many ways, but one is simply 90 years old and he's doing this stuff.
One of the greatest storytellers of all time. I won't go into detail if he didn't, but did he tell the story about finally getting to meet his matinee idol, Cary Grant, about working across from him and having lunch with him?
He did tell that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't retell it
No one can.
Yeah.
If you haven't heard the story, find it on YouTube. It's easy to find, but it's Mel Brooks' story about meeting Cary Grant.
And he did the Cary Grant voice really poorly like he does, and it makes it even more funny.
Yeah.
And he told some really bad jokes, and he said, now I'm going to tell you some really bad jokes, and he did some jokes that my father-in-law, who worked in a burlesque and all that, told, you know, like, my wife complained she never goes anywhere, so finally I took her somewhere she's never been before. To the kitchen. Yes.
Good.
And it's still funny.
Yeah, it is still
funny. It's also the way he says it. So I think he could say the first, pick five names out of the phone book and read them, and it would be fun.
Yeah, he's that good, isn't he?
Yep.
Good. I'm glad you got to see him. I never have.
Thrill.
Have you, Mike? Have you ever seen him in person?
Not.
He's such a talented guy.
Yeah.
All right, some pet talk with you, Steve. Since you are a noted pet expert, it'd be silly to ignore that. This time of year, the summer months, it gets very, very hot in a car, and yet people have a propensity for leaving their dog or maybe their cat inside a car. Explain how this is such a horrible idea.
Well, it's against the law now in where we live in Chicago, in the state of Illinois, and in many other places around the country, to leave a dog or any animal in a hot car. So I thought, you know, how hot really can it get? I mean, are some of these numbers that we've read exaggerations? So I went into a hot car because I come up with these ideas that aren't always very good ideas. So I came up with this idea and I thought, okay, I'm going to sit in a hot car. But no, that's not good enough because dogs are always wearing a coat, right?
Yeah.
So I borrowed my wife's fake fur coat. So I'm sitting in the car and I've got a winter hat on. But that's appropriate that dogs are always dressed and dogs don't release heat as well as we do. So I did have the advantage of perspiring. Mm-hmm. Dogs, for the most part, don't have that advantage. So I'm sitting in the car and it was kind of a day like today. It was about 80 degrees. It wasn't extraordinarily hot out. Nice cool breeze off the lake. We conducted this experiment at the Anti-Cruelty Society on their roof parking deck.
Mm-hmm.
And we videotaped it all. You can see it at stevedale.tv. And yeah, we started off with the temperature being about 80-ish inside the car. And within 20 minutes, it was 130.
Wow.
The GoPro that we used to help record this kept dying because it got so hot.
Yeah.
So GoPros are supposed to be strong and have endurance. And this one didn't have, I mean, how I understand it was 130 degrees plus inside the car in 15 to 20 minutes.
So is there, I mean, I know obviously you should never leave
dogs
a pet inside
die.
A car.
They'll die.
But is there, like, for somebody saying, I just need to run into the gas station really, really quickly and pay for my gas, is there a safe amount of time where if you have to do it, you can get away with it or not?
I suppose if you run in and really just pay for and it takes you 30 seconds to do. The problem is, what if something happens? What if the credit card isn't working, you know? And you're standing there and you say, well, let me try another credit card. Let me try another. Sure, for 30 seconds, literally 30 seconds, no problem. So, and if your dog is with you and you've got the windows rolled down and a nice cool breeze is coming in and you're driving along, completely different story than leaving a dog inside a car, even if the windows are down just a little bit, which they were in my grand experiment.
You know what I would suggest? Anytime you drive in the car with your dog, dress like you were just describing. Like, wear the fur coat.
Put a coat on.
And the winter hat. And if you're too hot, then it's too hot
dog. That's a good way to follow.
And in general, even without the fur coat and the hat, if you're too hot, it's too hot for your dog.
Here's a text. How do you feel, Steve, about people tying their dog up to a pole and then going into a place like Starbucks? I hate that. That's a different, I mean, I get why that could bother somebody, but that's a totally different issue than being locked up in a car, right?
Well, it bothers me because if the dog is sitting out in the sun, the dog can't go into the shade. There's not necessarily water out there for the dog, but there's a whole host of other issues. What if the dog gets loose? And that does happen, by the way. Mm-hmm. So if the dog gets loose and the dog is running down the street, now you've got a lost dog or a dog potentially that can get hit by a car. Or you're not there to supervise. The dog's upset. Little kid comes to pet the dog. Maybe the little kid is inappropriate, or maybe mom is inappropriate when mom says, your dog bit my kid, but you're not there to see what happened or did not happen, so there's no way you can know that. If the dog is without supervision, so many bad things can happen. So I don't like that idea, and in fact, nobody knows this, but I wish people did. In Chicago, it's against the Animal Control Act. I know it because I helped write it, where you are not, and we're one of the only cities in the country, it's actually against the law to tie out your dog in front of a coffee house.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, no. Well, the police officers generally don't know it either. It's not enforced.
Yeah.
But we did that because it's just not a good idea to do. There's a product called the Dog Parker, and it's a little doghouse. They're trying it out in Brooklyn. And it's got some air conditioning in it. It has some heating in it for the winter. It has disinfected between uses, so it's disinfected automatically. It's like a little doghouse that the dog goes in. Now, it's not perfect for every dog, but it does keep the dog safe.
And where are these? I've never heard of
this
before.
Right now, it's in Brooklyn. It's kind of a startup.
Oh, okay.
But
do you
I think
anticipate it coming here at any
maybe
time?
Maybe. It's it's an interesting idea.
It's a great idea.
Yeah, in some ways.
Yes. A couple of other things to discuss with you. World pet population. Is this a pressing issue? What happened with world pet? What happened? Has there been an influx of pets?
I think it's a good thing. So, you know, we think of the way we love animals, and it's kind of like what Americans do, I think. We just think about our country. And we're not alone here. Pets are beloved all over the globe, and the number of pets is up. Now, America leads the race in having pets. But we see other countries and we think of other countries, and I did a blog post about this, something I feel very strongly about. But there's data to support this as well. So in Mexico, there are a heck of a lot of animals. Mm-hmm. And the presumption is that in Mexico, they don't treat them very well. Well, sometimes, sadly, that's the case. But sometimes in this country, we don't treat them very well either. Think of all the animals that we have that are relinquished to animal shelters and actually die inside animal shelters. In fact, our numbers in America exceed any other country when it comes to that. So here's a country that half of our dogs sleep in our beds.
Yeah.
That we 90% of pet owners consider pets members of the family.
Yeah.
Yet we allow this to happen. So it's a complicated issue.
Mm-hmm.
But one that's interesting is that a couple things. First of all, we cannot deny at this point that we have evolved with dogs. All of us in this room, even you, Bill.
I don't know if that's true, but go ahead. I'm listening.
We have. Yeah. Archaeologically, we know that's the case. Longer story to explain it, but I'm happy to. But we have actually, as a species, evolved with dogs.
Alongside, almost as a team.
Yeah,
saying,
that's
right?
actually
yeah?
true. Okay. That's actually very, very right. true. So maybe we are hardwired to live our lives with dogs.
Yeah.
And in fact, very few people, unless they've had a bad experience with the dog, mm-hmm. try this sometime. Borrow a dog.
All right.
Walk down a street, and people will smile at you like mm-hmm. they haven't before.
Yeah.
Now, you're used to people laughing at you
I've
or with
that
you.
Happen, right.
That's, yeah, that's
sure.
different.
Yeah.
But truly, we almost can't help it. And then the endorphins in our head do a little happy dance. And the other thing is that the human-animal bond is not restricted to this country or any one culture. It is all around the world.
More people have dogs or cats? Which one?
Well, that's a really good question. So it depends on whose numbers you're looking at, but it seems as though there are more cats on the planet as pets
yeah.
than dogs. Although it could be that more people live with dogs than live with cats.
All right. And then what would be in the U.S., Steve, if dogs and cats are number one and number two, what's number three? What's
rabbits.
Is it rabbits, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I didn't see that coming.
Rabbits followed by ferrets.
And where are tropical fish?
Well, it's hard to count them because...
Right. right. They won't stay still. They're always moving. You know, I almost got through the whole aquarium, and then you guys shuffled the deck.
When they stay still, then you have a problem. This one's not moving at all.
Right. It might be time to switch out on that one. All right.
That's not what I meant.
So as one person might have one dog or one cat, you could have 25 fish. That's what
right.
you're saying.
Yes,
impossible.
Yes, or sometimes right. 50 fish, and
I
they
get
change
that.
Out frequently and all right. that. Worldwide, dogs account for 33% of pets, according to one survey.
Yeah.
Cats are 23%. According
oh, that
to
big
another
of a
survey,
I didn't see that big of a difference.
Yeah, according to another survey, it's much closer with cats in the lead. Fish are at 12%, but as I say, though, many of the surveys just don't count fish quite the same because of what you suggest.
And did you say ferrets were number four?
In America, yes.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
My brother had a ferret when I was growing up for a little while.
Really?
And it's a weasel,
it's a
let's be honest.
Yeah.
It's a weasel.
Well, they're related, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They're all in the mustelid family.
But you know, a friend of ours has had a pet weasel. Do you know what he named it?
No.
Or a ferret, rather. He
what?
Named it Leif.
Leif ferret.
Yeah.
A salute to Leif Garrett.
Yeah. That's, you'd have to be like in a certain age group to understand.
Right, sure.
Why
it's
that's
obscure,
funny.
But that
but
is Leif, very funny.
Leif ferret, yeah.
The problem with
like
my
that.
Brother's ferret was, number one, it wouldn't get a job. My brother said, I'll take you in, but you have got to find work, and it never happened. But it would always eat the bottom of the curtains or the dust ruffle on the bed or anything low enough to get at. The ferret just had at it every day.
Yeah, you have to kind of ferret-proof your home. They're very inquisitive, and they get into the smallest places
right.
because they have, like I'm told you do, a flexible backbone.
Right, I also have a flexible
yeah.
backbone.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
He does.
And you could twist all the way back.
If I want to.
Yes,
what?
Yes.
Yep, I choose not to, but I could if I needed to. All right, it's Bill F. along with Mike Toomey, and noted pet expert Steve Dale is our guest. If you have any questions or comments, or if you're a ferret that wants to offer up an opposing viewpoint, we're at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Mike on WGN. It's Bill F., and it's Mike Toomey sitting in for Wendy Snyder, and it's noted pet expert Steve Dale. He's noted internationally. A lot of texts coming in, Steve. This one says this. This is from 630. I forgot which state, but last year, a cop made a woman sit in her hot car after he found her dog in it. Did you ever hear this story? Do you know if this is true or not?
I did hear that story, yes. Yeah, I think Georgia, but I'm not sure.
Could be. 616 says, over in Europe, people take their dogs everywhere. Grocery stores, restaurants, shops. I don't get why the U.S. can't handle this. Explain why that doesn't go on in the United States.
We just have...
health laws.
Well, yes, at the end of the day, yeah, you cannot take in any of the states a dog inside a restaurant here in this country. But in Europe, in many countries, I learned that there was a little hook on the table.
Yeah.
And I thought that was for, like, coats that belong to small people.
Sure.
I didn't know. It turns out... what do I know? It turns out to be for leashes.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, yeah, really, truly.
So you can tie, just tie it up to that little small hook.
So it's not for Billy Barty when he joins you.
If he visits you while you're eating.
Cafe.
No, no. 847, what do you think of this, Steve? My pet peeve is people driving with a pet in their lap. We've all seen this at some point.
Yeah,
somebody's driving erratically and you look over and it's because they have a basset hound that they're teaching to drive the car.
Right.
I agree. It's dangerous to do that.
Dangerous for all parties involved,
it's
right?
Dangerous no matter what. Yes. So if the pet is sitting in the passenger seat, it's dangerous because if you stop suddenly, then the pet keeps going and goes right through the windshield.
Right.
Especially if it's a small dog, and it usually is a small dog sitting in a lap. If it's in the driver's seat, it's dangerous for a whole host of, I think, pretty obvious reasons. And again, it's one of those things that's against the law, but maybe not enforced.
Do you think it's possible to teach a dog to drive a stick shift?
Yes.
It is.
How?
I don't know. I just thought I'd answer
him
that
way.
Right. It's harder.
They cannot grab the thing.
That's preposterous.
No, it's preposterous.
Steve, you wanted to talk about Zika Patrol. What did you want to share with us about Zika Patrol?
Well, I don't know if you can see this. I have, as I Facebook you live, but you see the bump here?
I do see the bump. On the side of Steve's neck, there's a sizable welt.
Yeah, it's a mosquito bite.
Is that right?
Yeah,
yeah. That's a big mosquito bite.
Well, the big mosquitoes. And they're here, and they carry all sorts of bad things, including the Zika virus, which is here too. Now, the good news for dog owners is it seems dogs don't get the Zika virus. If they do, they don't seem to get sick from it. Giving puppies is not a problem.
Right.
And no birth defect issues, as far as anyone knows. But heartworm is something dogs do get, and it can be deadly. So we do need to protect our dogs from heartworm disease. We also need to protect them from fleas and ticks, as I've talked about a lot on the radio.
Yeah.
Now, here's a cool idea. There's a flea and tick preventive that works really well, does what it's supposed to do, no fleas, no ticks, if you use the Spot-On product. But it also both deters and kills mosquitoes. And if in the backyard, now, the other thing you have to know, mosquitoes go after dogs just as they go after people.
Yeah.
In fact, maybe more so.
Yeah.
Probably just because where dogs are. They go into the bushes, they're at a lower level, easy for mosquitoes to get at, and they do. So we can go outside and get 10 bites, our dogs might get 50. 50, 5-0.
Yeah.
So if a mosquito is going toward your dog and goes to bite your dog, and you're using a product called Vectra 3D, which also kills mosquitoes, you're actually providing somewhat of a public service by killing those mosquitoes. It's also double protection against heartworm.
Where is Vectra 3D available?
Any veterinary clinic.
They'll all have it.
Yeah.
Every one of them has it.
Yeah, it's kind of a secret that ought not be a secret.
Promise me you'll get that mosquito bite looked at, because that's that's like 10 times the size of a normal mosquito bite. I don't know what kind of mosquito bit you, but I would seriously look into that.
Let me see.
Is it?
You can see it.
Yeah, that's like
see
a
it?
Conjoined twin.
Yeah.
Is it growing as I speak?
When you started telling us about it, it was big, and now I can't
bigger.
Even see your face anymore.
Yeah, it was scowling at me just a second ago. Like,
I am very, very excited.
Because?
On June 18th,
yeah.
A big party. We
What's
all like parties.
Everyone loves a party.
Yes,
this party
is at Chicago Animal Care and Control. It's at 2:30. Now, the 18th is this coming Saturday. Animal Care and Control is at 2741 Southwestern Avenue. Now, as you know, I did the first interview with the new executive director of Chicago Animal Care and Control.
I know that.
Yeah,
I remember.
This past Sunday on WGN on my show.
Yeah.
You could see the podcast of that or hear it
on
my website, and that's stevedale.tv, which links back to the WGN website. But we also talked about this event that's happening. They have a new pavilion, a couple of them there, and they'd like to give you a tour for free.
And when is this?
This coming Saturday from noon to 2:30. Noon to 2:30. I'm going to pop by at some point. It's at 2741 Southwestern Avenue, which is Chicago Animal Care and Control.
Excellent. And if people come early, will you show them your mosquito bite?
Yes. I will show them my mosquito bite, yes.
All right. The mosquito bite will introduce itself to the person.
Really?
Oh, I'm the huge, right. Steve's neck.
Well, that's worth the price of admission right there. Who would be silly enough to take a pass on that?
It's free. I have more exciting news.
What? You have more exciting news?
I could do this in one sentence.
Go ahead.
We like opossum because it turns out they eat ticks.
What?
Yeah, I know. Who knew? I didn't know that. I just discovered this. So if you see a possum and they're acting dead, do mouth to mouth to bring them back to life because we want a possum.
That's solid advice to the kids.
I think it is.
Right.
It's just good.
If you see an animal on the side of the road, give it mouth to mouth. You can't possibly go wrong.
Okay, maybe don't.
Pull over. That's
possum. Steve, where can people hear you or see you or look at your mosquito bite?
They can hear me Sunday morning at 6:30 on WGN. They could see my mosquito bite if they go to my Facebook page because I'm Facebooking live now.
Right.
And they can find me at stevedale.tv.
That's Steve Dale. He's a noted pet expert. You know that it's true. Thank you, Steve.
Noted.
Great to see you. We'll take a quick break, and then Steve Bertrand has the news. It's WGN. Steve, thanks very much. Steve, you can hang out for this part, too, if you're not busy. Mike Toomey is sitting in for Wendy. Wendy will be back tomorrow. Wendy's on a court-ordered vacation just to make things right again. She'll be back tomorrow. Mike, how often do you use the English language? Are you a big fan of the English language?
I would say almost every day.
Nearly every day you use the English language.
Yeah.
There's a little piece I found, and I said, I'm going to wait till my friend Mike is here because Mike will understand this better than anybody. These are phrases that we commonly use here in America that nobody really knows the origin of. I'm curious to see if you know the origin of any of these phrases.
The meaning's changed over time.
Over time, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've heard people say this, toot your own horn.
Right.
I don't want to toot my own horn. Where does that come from, do you think?
Well, I think it's just a figure of speech. They're saying, like, you're blowing your own horn because nobody else will. You're saying, hey, look at me. Look at what I just did.
Make some loud noise. Call attention to myself.
Look what I just did.
Yep. Back in the 16th century, the arrival of a VIP into town was signaled by the trumpeting of horns. If a person blows their own horn or toots their own horn, it is still seen as being proud or arrogant. So, yeah, I think you nailed that one. You got that one. You're one for one. What does this mean? Sit tight.
Hang on a second.
Sit tight. Where does that come from?
Give it time.
Yep.
Because maybe people are antsy and they get out of their seat instead of just waiting.
You're close. You're very close. The phrase's history doesn't seem to be very complicated. A person who is sitting literally, tightly, will be unmoved. If someone asks you to sit tight, they want you to take no further action until told otherwise. So, I think you got that one, too.
Yeah, right? Stay in your seat.
Mm-hmm. Up in the air. If somebody's up in the air about something, where does that come from?
It's undecided, right? We've tossed our figurative question up there, and we're waiting for it to come down.
Yep. The phrase is particularly poetic. If something is up in the air, then it is simply floating around. It is unsettled. Apparently, English speakers said up in the air back in the 1800s and still say it today.
Mm-hmm. But why?
It doesn't really explain. Yeah.
Why you would toss it up there.
It doesn't explain why. Something must have happened. Was this the advent of passenger balloons, Steve?
I don't know.
1800s? Maybe. I'm not sure.
I learned one this weekend. I was actually watching a TV show called Go Medieval.
What is that? I've never heard of Go
Medieval.
I think
it was on the History Channel.
Yeah.
And they had a hawk. They were doing falconing.
Mm-hmm.
And the term fed up.
Mm-hmm.
Is when the falcon or the hawk is full, you can see it in her neck. She's fed up.
Oh.
And in that case, then she won't fly or do anything more.
They've reached their limit.
That's right.
She's fed up. Either nutritionally or otherwise.
How about that?
I've never eaten that much food. Can you imagine eating so much food that you could see it in your neck?
But do you remember when you were a kid and you thought if you were full?
It was up to my neck.
Did you ever look in the mirror, open your mouth and look in to see if you could see the level of food?
Certainly.
Yeah. I think all kids do that. I thought when I was a kid that you only advanced height-wise on your birthday. I thought that on your birthday, that was the day that you grew an inch or something.
Sure.
Yeah. I'd measure myself at the beginning of my birthday and then at the end and think, well, I guess my growing is done. I haven't grown at all. What was the one I was trying to remember that I thought about? Oh, I've asked people that are linguists, people that know the language better than anybody, in boxing, you box in a boxing ring, but they're always square.
They're square.
Why wouldn't it be called a boxing square? Why would it be a ring? There's I've never seen proof that it ever took place in a round venue.
No.
But they always call them boxing rings.
They're boxing in the round.
You know, right.
They do that.
Right.
Have you ever done that? It's like a dinner theater.
Dinner in the round. Sure, theater in the round.
You have dinner and you watch guys fight.
That would be $1 million idea.
Yeah, boxing in the round.
I like it. Where does this phrase, and I've heard people say this, like white on rice.
Hmm.
Where would that come from? It says if you're encouraged to stay right on top of something, that's a task or a responsibility, you might be close to it as white is on rice, inseparable.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a little bizarre, but so is most of the English language. But again, Steve, to your point, they don't really explain why this became part of the language. I understand the meaning of it, but where did it come from?
Right, and there's different colors of rice.
Yeah, you know, nobody ever says it's like brown on rice.
Brown on rice.
It's always white on rice. Did you ever do this? You take a kid, and I recommend if you're going to do this to your own kid or somebody who's close to you's kid, and you pull their arm back, and you mm-hmm. say uncle.
Yeah.
Why? What is that
because
in tribute to?
Because he's the only one who can save you right now.
Your uncle is the only one.
Yeah.
Is that true?
It's Uncle Arthur from Bewitched.
From Bewitched?
Paul Lind, whose birthday would be today if you were alive.
Oh, happy birthday,
yeah,
Paul Lind.
He would save you.
Magically.
I'm thinking that's it. Yes, by magic. Paul Lind.
Your opponent might ask you to cry or to say uncle. Now, that's something I think that's been lost generationally.
Right. You don't see that now.
I can't imagine a kid now pulling that.
Right. He would like get him down and pull his arm and say uncle, and the kid would be like, what do you, I don't know.
Say
what do you
uncle?
Mean? What do you mean?
What does that mean? But there was always like a bully kid. Even when we were kids, that was already coming to an end.
Sure.
But it was at its final days,
mm-hmm.
right? Your opponent may mm-hmm. ask you to cry or to say uncle as a means of surrendering. It's a particularly inexplicable phrase, and it may trace its origins way back to the Roman Empire, when it's believed that children cried out for their patrus, what is that, P-A-T-R-U-U-S, to help them when being bullied. I think to fully understand this, I need to know what a patrus is.
It's your dad's brother.
Is that what it means back in the Roman Empire?
Who settles differences. He's paternal, right? And he institutes a truce.
So that would be the guy,
and
a patrus.
That's how you get the truce. Like, hey, quit breaking his arm, we need a truce. And this guy, your dad's brother from the paternal side, comes in and settles.
That makes more sense.
Settles the differences.
What if it is your uncle, in fact, who's the one pulling your arm back? Then what do you cry or yell out?
You got to hope there's another uncle out
right.
there somewhere.
Right,
hope
maternal
your dad
uncle.
Dad is one of three at least.
Darn it, Dad. You only have the
your
one
dad,
brother.
Your dad can't do anything about it.
I'm going to be stuck like this forever.
It's not in the rules.
More phrases that you probably didn't know the meaning of. Give us a call if you have any. 312-981-7200. We're here for you. It's Bill F. and Mike Toomey sitting in for Wendy Snyder on WGN. It's Bill Laff, along with Mike Toomey. You know Mike is one of our city's finest stand-up comics, certainly. He's also on the WGN-TV Morning News quite regularly. Enjoy him there. Mike is filling in for Wendy today. Wendy will be back tomorrow. We've got a bunch of phrases and their origins. Mm-hmm. These are phrases you've heard constantly throughout your life, but you don't know where they're from. A couple of days ago, one of my daughters, Reese, was watching television with me, and the news was on, and they were talking about Hillary Clinton, and they said that for a time they were explaining a part of Hillary Clinton's career where she was wearing two hats, and then they kept talking about her. And then finally Reese goes, I don't remember ever seeing her even wear one hat. When was she wearing two hats?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was very funny. And
right.
I said, well, you know what that means, right?
Means,
and Reese said, I don't think I've ever heard this.
Of your head.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a time when haberdashers would make hats.
And Hillary Clinton was famous for that.
Right. Right. Which led for her presumptive nomination. People enjoyed that about her. But that's another phrase. I don't think people say that regularly anymore.
She could throw one in the ring and still have a hat on.
Right. That's the beauty of that.
Yeah.
On a cold day.
I threw one of my hats in the ring and I'm still wearing a hat.
She's covered. Now, the one I wonder about, and it's not on this list. I was looking to see if it was on it. But my whole life I've heard about people cleaning someone's clock. I'm going to clean that guy's clock.
Yeah.
And it means I'm going to punch them out.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that have to do with clock cleaning?
Mm.
Why would that be?
I don't know.
That's totally different.
Have you ever cleaned a clock, Bill?
I've never cleaned a clock.
Well, I guess you wouldn't know then.
Bill's clocks are filthy.
Right. Michael attested to this. You've been to my house. Yeah. Remember you came to my house one time and you're like, I got to go. What time is it?
Yeah.
And I couldn't tell because my clock is so dirty.
It's a beautiful place, but these clocks. Don't you ever clean? I'm going to clean your clock. That's what I'm going.
And then I asked you to leave. I thought you were going to punch me.
Yeah. I said, I'm going to go over to Bill's house and I'm going to clean that guy's clock.
I said to my wife, we can't have Mike over anymore. Yeah. He threatened me.
Poor guy doesn't know what time it is.
That was the ugliest moment of my life,
yeah,
right there.
I didn't mean anything by it.
I was sure you were going to.
Just wanted to help.
Oh, my God. I was scared for my life. 312-981-7200. What are the phrases? Do you know the meaning? Are you curious about the meaning? Let's find out. Let's talk to John. Hey, John, how are you?
I'm good, Bill. How are you?
Excellent, sir. Excellent.
All right, I've got a couple for you.
Sure.
Okay. Highfalutin and riffraff.
Well, highfalutin always, to me, sounds like something from the Old West.
Yeah, but it's like ritzy, like a higher class, right?
That's right.
A highfalutin.
Better than the norm. Yeah, do you know where that comes from, John?
I do. It's Mississippi riverboat culture. Back in those days, if you could afford the best seat on a riverboat, you were up on the high deck near the flutes where all the smoke
was. Oh.
So you're highfalutin.
That makes perfect sense.
And you were highfalutin. Now, the people down below, the Huck Finns and the Tom Sawyers, they would be on rafts made of driftwood.
Yeah.
They were referred to as drift rafts. And they eventually became
drifters.
Riffraff.
You're kidding.
Is that drifters? Do they become drifters?
No, they became riffraff. They were
riffraff.
Drift rafts, and then that would just somehow evolved into
riffraff.
So you were like the low class and the high class.
That makes perfect sense.
I got one more for you,
please,
might like.
Sure.
Okay, over the top. When someone is referred to going over the top.
A little too much.
Over the top.
Yeah. What does that mean? Where does that come from?
That comes from World War I trench warfare, where when you were just about to give up and you were going to go Rambo, you would go over the top of the trench into no man's land where you were sure to be shot.
It makes perfect sense, too. Wow. Well, John, thank you. Those are great.
That's all I got.
That's all you need. You're set.
I just thought riffraff.
Make sure your clocks are clean if you ever invite Mike Toomey to your house, John. Promise me.
Will do.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Riffraff was an underdog villain.
One
That's
of the,
what I thought.
The best of the underdog villains.
Would you like a little lead from my machine gun underdog? I knew I was going to get a riffraff.
You got a good riffraff. If we can somehow get to Simon Bar Sinister, then we've got a full day. Let's talk to Bob. He has one. Now, Bob, before you tell us what the phrase is, do you know what the origin of it is, or are you just trying to find out what it is?
No, I'm asking the two wise men.
Let's see if we can get it.
Ground.
All right,
stand your ground.
Stand your ground. Hmm. Well, obviously, it just means...
territory.
Yeah, you got to make sure your territory is safe. It belongs to you. But I don't know why that wording in particular came to be. Do you?
No, I don't. I'm going to give you one more before you hang up on it.
Sure.
If... I'm waiting, in a smoking gun. We always hear that in trials and stuff. What the hell is a smoking gun when you?
Well, obviously, it just means the gun's just been shot recently.
This is your evidence right here. This is your clue.
This is the biggest clue we can give you is that the gun still has smoke on it, thus guilt.
Yeah, you shot that often.
I got it.
That one makes sense. Thanks, Bob. Take care. Have a great day. Let me see if I can get one more call in really quickly. Colleen knows a little something. Colleen, go ahead. What do you know?
Hi. Sleep tight.
Yeah.
Is that
where does that come from?
Something to do with the way that you're tucked in with the blankets?
Well, close, I guess. Back in the day, I don't know what day, but like years and years ago, they didn't have, springs. They had ropes that you would put your mattress on top of. And you had to take a special tool and tighten the ropes before you went to bed. So that's where the sleep tight comes in.
So you were literally sleeping tight. You had to make it tight for it to work.
Absolutely.
That makes sense, too.
Otherwise, you have like the equivalent of a saggy
mattress.
Saggy
bed. Yeah. No one wants
that. Right, which I have that now.
Oh, no.
You need some rope.
You got to get some rope, Colleen.
I don't know where this is going.
I know. It got dangerous.
Sleep tight.
Thanks, Colleen.
Sleep tight.
All right, thank you.
And what's the second part of sleep tight? Everybody's mom said this at some point in their career.
Good night, sleep tight?
Good night, sleep tight. Don't let the bed bugs bite.
Which is bigger now than ever.
Yeah. Yeah. Our moms actually knew a little something because back then, Bed Bugs, they were just like a fairy tale.
We didn't know anything about
it. Didn't get to where it got now. All right, we need to take a quick break. In a little bit, Steve will give you the news, and then we're going to talk to Tom Ahern. Tom has been with us on the show before. He's with the ATF. He'll talk a little bit about what went on in Orlando over the weekend, a tragic story, as you all know. So stick around. A lot more show coming your way. It's Bill F. along with Mike Toomey sitting in for Wendy on WGN. It's Bill F. and it's Mike Toomey sitting in for Wendy. Wendy will be back tomorrow. Right now we're going to talk to Tom Ahern. Tom is a senior special agent with the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives, to talk about his angle on what's going on there in Orlando, Florida, after yesterday's horrific events. Tom, thank you very much for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Bill, for having me.
Beside the obvious, which is what happened was just an awful, 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 awful day for all of America, for all the world. Everything that happened yesterday was awful. Where does your bureau come in exactly in a case like this, Tom?
Well, first of all, Bill, on behalf of all the law enforcement and first responders who are working that scene in Orlando, we want to express our sincere condolences to the victims and their families and loved ones. This has been just another horrific event in our nation's history, and they're very difficult scenes to work, even for the well-seasoned law enforcement officers and first responders. We've had far too many of these mass shootings in our country, at schools and nightclubs and movie theaters, places of worship, and these incidents unfortunately have become part of the fabric of our country. Where now law enforcement has made a quote unquote an active shooter situation part of our ongoing training. That's what's come of all these mass shootings in our country. So we just want to express our responses too.
And what you just said, Tom, about how now that's part of the training, that's fairly recent that it's become part of the training, isn't it?
It has. I mean, basically, it's been ramped up because of the frequency in the last few years, and it's very much a part of the law enforcement training.
And Orlando sadly had not one but two incidents. They had the girl from The Voice who was shot and killed on Friday night, and then of course the situation that we're all talking about from late Saturday into Sunday morning. How awful for any city to have to endure two of those events in one weekend.
Oh, absolutely. And whenever you have the combination of a person who is filled with hate and is in possession of a gun, It's just a very, very dangerous combination. And, right now in Orlando, at the scene of the nightclub, I mean, there's just a massive investigation that's ongoing. There's such a great deal of work that still needs to be done and will be done in a very methodical, thorough manner. First of all, I mean, to determine, was he inspired or was he enabled by others, or possibly was he self-radicalized? So the timeline of his movements and his actions will all have to be established, which is a major undertaking. But they'll look very closely at all of his electronic devices, his iPhone, his computer. They'll all be analyzed in hopes of gaining intelligence information as to what his motive was, why he carried this out, why he chose this particular location on this day to carry out his terrorist massacre. So all of that is still being investigated.
Tom, are you of the belief, I heard this alluded to yesterday on several different television shows that were covering the events, that if he were a lone wolf, if this was just a guy not with any affiliations to any terrorist groups, that it's harder to describe, it's harder to kind of figure out a motive for him as just somebody. I think his dad was the first one to say that he had seen two men kissing earlier, a month or so ago, and it disturbed him, and he wanted revenge on that. If he's not affiliated to any terrorist group, if this is just a guy with private thoughts in his head, then it's hard to come up with motives, isn't it?
These investigations are very, very challenging for law enforcement. It's basically the intelligence surrounding and intelligence gathering surrounding an investigation like this is basically it's intelligence triage, where you're trying to prioritize all the information that's coming in, and then you're that's on your currently on your radar, and you prioritize that and investigate it. You know, so these cases are very, very challenging.
Tom, I'm curious about this. At the very beginning of the show, at the very start of the show at 10 o'clock, we talked about the story a little bit, and somebody called up and said, this is not a story about guns. Don't make this a story about guns. You're with the Department of Justice. Is this or isn't this a story about guns?
I could tell you this, Bill. ATF, and we enforce the federal firearms laws. And under the Gun Control Act of 1968, The American citizens have the constitutional right to buy a firearm and to own a firearm unless they've been convicted of a felony, a prior felony, they've been adjudicated mentally ill, they have a domestic violence conviction, or they're currently under indictment for a felony. Other than that, if those aren't present, there's nothing prohibiting a person from purchasing a firearm. And in this case, it appears that he purchased those guns legally.
Now, this was a guy, and I'm sure you're well aware of this. He was kind of on an FBI watch list. They had interviewed him a couple of times. There were complaints from his coworkers that he was unstable, that he was constantly making how do I say it politely? Racist comments and suggestions that were disturbing a lot of people. But he had never done anything illegal. I know he had a very rough relationship with his ex-wife, and that's one issue. But he had never done anything that was anywhere a red flag to what he did over the weekend. So what do you do with a guy who's obviously a problem child but hasn't done anything to make you realize that he could have done what he eventually did?
Well, that's he was on the FBI's radar, and they did look at him. And they did speak with him, from what I understand, in the past. And it's what I talked about earlier, where they basically have to, it's such a challenge with all the intelligence information coming in, all the individuals that are on this radar, you basically have to prioritize which ones you feel are the greatest threat or could potentially become a threat. And that's who you focus most of your attention on. So that's basically where he stood.
But Tom, here's where it becomes difficult, and you already know this, but I'll say it anyway. If we're constantly told, if you see something, say something. So in this case, you have a couple of coworkers who are following those orders. We've seen something. We've seen a guy with a very short fuse who seems to blow up easily. Now we're saying something, and then there's no real result because he hasn't done anything illegal. It kind of ties all of our hands, doesn't it?
Right. Well, if you look at his wife, his ex-wife, if in fact she reported the domestic abuse, and if he was convicted of that or indicted for that at the time, he would have been a prohibited person from buying those guns legally.
And then, so
oftentimes, Bill, you know, what we find too is even if a person is a prohibited individual who has a prior felony conviction or a domestic violence conviction of some sort that would prohibit him from buying a gun legally, there's still a black market out there for guns. And if an individual is motivated enough to carry out whatever hate crime he or she wanted to do, they're going to find a way to get a gun.
Tom, where do you stand on this? I've mentioned this on the show before, but I'm anxious to hear your opinion. these acts are so random, it's impossible to keep an eye on everybody who's potentially dangerous. It's a weird combination of possibly mental illness, possibly religious beliefs, possibly hatred towards, in this guy's case, gay people. There's so many different elements and components to throw in there that it is virtually impossible to predict or prevent something like this from happening, right?
Well, there are so many soft targets that are out there where an individual who wants to carry out a hate crime, and we've seen it in recent history in the United States here, the school shootings, the nightclubs, the movie theaters, the places of worship, those are all soft targets. And that's what America stands for. I mean, to be able to have the freedom to go to these places with your family and your friends and not have to worry about coming under attack from a deranged gunman. And so it's basically a trade-off. I mean, we have to be, we know that that's part of our world right now, and that possibility is always there, but we cannot live in fear, and we can't let these terrorist organizations instill fear in all of us. We have to go on and live our lives and just be vigilant about it. And if there is something that stands out, yes, you have to come forward with that information and to law enforcement, and hopefully we'd be able to head something off.
Tom, I know we don't have a lot of time with you, but I'm curious, what happens over the next couple of days? I know, as you pointed out, there are people pouring through any of his email correspondence and maybe his phone records and cell phone records, that sort of thing.
Sure.
But take us through the rest of what the next few days will bring there in Orlando, Florida.
Well, basically, the crime scene is still very active, and it's going to be worked in a very meticulous, methodical manner. Every shell casing has to be photographed and collected and analyzed, and the timeline has to be reconstructed of the shooter's movements. When he arrived, the things he said, the phone calls that he made, all of those have to be recreated, so to speak, in order to know what his movements were. That's just the investigative part of working the scene. Then there's the background on the shooter himself. You know, what his motivations were.
Yeah.
Hopefully, his iPhone, his computer. Once all of that is completely analyzed, they'll be able to gain more intelligence information as to whether he was radicalized or whether he was inspired by someone. And so there's still a great deal of work to be done. And you know, there's the one thing I wanted to add is the psychological long-term impact on the families of the victims, mm-hmm. and their loved ones, and also the survivors. And I'll take it a step further, the first responders. The first responders working a scene like this, law enforcement and first responders, we're all human too. And we have families and loved ones, and to walk into a scene like that and work that scene is very difficult. You know, but we have to... That's what the first responders do. I mean, yeah. They willingly risk their own lives in order to save the lives of the innocent people out there. So, you know, we salute them.
Tom, thank you for spending time with us. I certainly wish this discussion was under better circumstances, but we always appreciate your expertise. Thank you so much for this.
You're welcome, Bill.
Take care.
You too.
That's Senior Special Agent Tom Ahern, Public Information Officer with U.S. Department of Justice, ATF Division, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. With, as he just pointed out, a lot more going on there in Orlando over the next couple of days. We have to take a quick break. We'll come back and then more show. It's Bill F. and Mike Toomey sitting in for Wendy Snyder on WGN. For those of you who don't know Mike, of course, a fine, fine stand-up comic for many, many years, also a fixture on the WGN TV morning news, Chicago's must-watch morning news,
by
the way.
It is must-watch.
You
yes.
have to watch. You have a
to.
Say in this.
I really wish that I could say you had options, but you
there
don't.
Are no other options.
You really have to.
Sorry, that's it.
But I'm sorry. But you have to.
Don't be sorry. It's a great show.
You'll thank us later.
It really is. Here's what they, and you already know this, here's what they do the best of. They do the best on reporting the news from 360 degrees, and then it's really fun on top of it.
Yep. There's a lot of fun things.
It really is.
And that's how it should be.
It should be that way. But other stations don't seem to know that.
That's better for us.
You guys cornered the market on that. But you're happy with the way things are going there.
Yeah, it's great.
Now, here's what I saw a couple of weeks ago, and I wanted to call you and ask you about this. You do incredible impressions when you're doing stand-up, when you're doing the WGN Morning News, when you're doing your own one-man show, TV mm-hmm. and Me. You do a multitude of great impressions. Now, there's some kid on, and I don't know this kid's name, but that kid was really pretty good. He's a local kid.
19 years old.
He's 19.
Yeah.
He was very good.
He was really good.
Did you hate him?
No.
Because he was impeding on your territory?
Yeah, well, I'm not 19 anymore. So, he has the market. Boy, he's good. On 19-year-old kids who do dead on impersonations.
You know who he did that impressed me was Michael Douglas. I had never seen anyone do Michael Douglas.
Yes.
But he, and I would, like, if you stopped me and said, do you think this kid will even know who Michael Douglas is? I go, no.
Right.
Not only did he know him, he did his voice really well.
Right. And when I was 19, I did William Demarest, and people were like, wow, that guy does William Demarest.
For people who don't know William Demarest, of course, Uncle Charlie on most seasons, not all seasons of My Three Sons, but most.
He was the only person to play that character.
He replaced Bub, William Frawley.
Yes,
right? Right.
There is a funny story about that, if you have time.
I have time. We make time for a good William Demarest story.
This is a William Frawley, William Demarest story.
Perfect.
William Frawley was a grandfather on there
for
My Three Sons. And was
the
getting...
The father-in-law, right?
He was Fred McMurray's father-in-law.
Father-in-law,
the grandfather of the sons, who was Fred Mertz on I Love Lucy. That's
correct.
Him.
Yeah.
Well, he was getting old and slowing down and wasn't really that efficient as the character anymore, so they let him go and brought in William Demarest to play Uncle Charlie. Well, William Frawley, went down swinging. I mean,
He
didn't want to leave.
Right.
So they said he kept showing up to the set during the early episodes with Uncle Charlie, like basically heckling him from behind the cameras.
He was heckling William Demarest.
He was giving him a hard time, like he came in and took his job. Can you imagine William Frawley? You suck. That's not how you play that role. And then William Demarest is firing back. Go home. Your time is past. I'm a young guy at 87. This is a young man's game, Frawley. Right, Steve?
You don't want to see friction between those two.
Yeah, and he says, right, Steve? And, of course, Fred McMurray wasn't there because he filmed all his scenes by himself.
Now, people, that's true.
Yes.
Is that when they signed Fred McMurray to be on My Three Sons, he was a movie actor and he wasn't used to TV.
Right.
And he said that the only way he would do it is if they could shoot all his scenes like within a month or 2 months or something, right?
Mm-hmm. Then he would just say all his lines with no one around him. And then later when the rest of the cast was there, they would stand in front of the chair where Fred McMurray was supposed to be sitting. And
respond to him.
Yeah.
Because I always read, I'm trying to remember where I read this, but they'd say because of this, they would shoot all the kitchen scenes like within a day or two, and then all the living room scenes and all the scenes in the hallway.
Nothing made sense.
It didn't make sense. And then also, because you're dealing with kids, the ones who played the three sons, they'd have growth spurts, or their hair would get longer or shorter, or they'd lose a tooth.
But then they would just have William Demarest say, isn't it weird how Ernie has sideburns? Wait, where did the sideburns go? And they covered it. Like, it was like weird stuff going on, but at least they acknowledged it.
You got to call attention to it.
Chip, you should shave. That's better.
Right. Problem solved.
Right.
You solved the problem. All right, we'll take a quick break, and then we'll find out what Roe and Anna have next. Stick around. It's Bill Leff and Mike Toomey sitting in for Wendy Snyder on WGN.